Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. Today is Wednesday, October 18th. I'm Stephen Overly. You could consider Suresh Venkatasubramanian to be the James Madison of artificial intelligence. History buffs will know that Madison authored the Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution. And Suresh, he helped write the AI Bill of Rights, a blueprint for protecting people against the harms of AI that the White House published just over a year ago. Soon, the Biden administration will follow that up with an executive order. It's been described to me as comprehensive and dense, and it's expected to give federal agencies detailed directions for buying and using AI technologies. Suresh left the White House last year. He now leads Brown University's Center for Technological Responsibility, Reimagination, and Redesign. On the show today, how he says the forthcoming executive order should build on the AI Bill of Rights. I guess my first question, I was just curious, as the son of a retired U.S. history teacher, I have to ask this. Was the goal to get this thing kind of tacked on to the Constitution along with the original Bill of Rights, or what was it?
Hey, we can dream. No, but no, I don't think the goal was to get it tacked onto the Constitution. I think the goal was to use the Bill of Rights, the original Bill of Rights, as inspiration for what it means to articulate protections for people against powerful entities who have a lot more power than them. Of course, back in the original day of the Bill of Rights, it was the state. And now it's companies that put out technology that affects our lives in so many different ways. And so the goal of this document was to articulate those principles very clearly with evidence and with constructive ideas. So you call them sweeping ideals, but they're really very pragmatic ideas, along with a bunch of technical developments that can help realize them in practice.
So sort of what the founding fathers might say about AI, although I think they probably would have had a different set of concerns and considerations back then. I guess now that we are a year out, it is sort of a good mile marker to ask, has enough progress been made in your view toward achieving the principles that were outlined?
I think we're making progress. I think, you know, obviously one would like everything to happen immediately. But it takes time. It takes time for ideas to get out there into the world and for people to think about them. So we're seeing progress on the regulatory front. We're seeing strong articulation of the recognition to do something about algorithmic regulation from the agencies like the FTC, CFPB, the EEOC, and the DOJ. We're seeing a number of states that have passed or are in the process of passing legislation that is either explicitly or implicitly inspired by the AI Bill of Rights. We are seeing a number of companies and consortia put out guidelines that acknowledge the need to put governance on AI, partly in response to the AI Bill of Rights, when it's explicitly acknowledged and partly not. I think we've changed the conversation. And I think that is more difficult to do than one might imagine and is more important than one might think, because for the longest time, we felt, you know, with any piece of tech, the goal is to put it out there and not worry too much about what the consequences are. And the fact that where everyone, and I was in a conversation just yesterday, where everyone from the legal side, from the corporate side, all agreed we do need governance for AI and there's no way about it, I think is a testament to the shift in conversation that has happened since we put out the document.
It does seem like a number of conversations have started. You know, how quickly they're moving, when they'll get to the finish line, I think is the question, right? But certainly more folks are talking about AI than a year ago. And at least in those conversations, there seems to be a greater awareness for some of the concerns that you have outlined in the Bill of Rights and that others have voiced as well. I guess I wonder, you know, are there areas in which you think we could be further along or should be further along than we are at this point when it comes to regulating AI or addressing some of these harms?
I don't know what should. Like I said, I want everything to happen now, and I would be much happier if we had laws on the books right now. I recognize these things take time, and sometimes perhaps it's better for people to think carefully about what they're doing and put in place guidelines that truly match the specific concerns that we have. So I would like us to keep moving towards legislation. I would like Congress to be doing, continuing to do the work that they've started, but actually end it. I would like the federal government to be doing as much as it can within its power. You mentioned the upcoming executive order, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, but that's another example of the federal government using its own power to be a role model, right? As a, both a user and consumer of AI, sort of to be a role model for how to do, use it responsibly. And I mean, I'm a professor. I'm teaching students, you know, all the time about how we can reimagine how we do the basic development of technology to keep these broader societal issues in mind at all times. And that's important as well. So I want all of these things and I want them all now, but I recognize it's a process. So I, you know, I try to stay patient and optimistic as well.
Patience is a key in Washington, to say the least. You know, we had Anne Neuberger from the National Security Council on the podcast, and she talked about this upcoming executive order on AI and sort of referred to it as essentially a bridge until Congress can pass some more substantial regulations or laws, if you will. Obviously, we've not read the executive order yet. It's expected to come out as soon as this month. But my understanding from what Politico's reported is that one of the main things it will address is sort of the government's own use of AI, and in particularly, you know, using kind of the government's purchasing power to perhaps have influence on the market. I wonder what you make of that approach, you know, using kind of the government's power as a buyer to shape how this market evolves.
I think that's entirely appropriate and a very smart move to do that. The government is a big client of software systems. The government is a market shaper. And that's an important role the government plays. And an executive order, just by nature of its scope and its limited scope, can only address what the government does. And I think procurement is an interesting thing, right? Because it's something the government where the government has an effect on the private sector indirectly, even if an executive order only pertains to what agencies do. I have talked a lot about the multi-pronged approach we need to bringing governance in. It's not just laws, but it is laws. It's not just regulation, but it is regulation. It's not just market incentives, but it is market incentives. And it is norm changing as well. I've talked about some of these things already, and I think this is an example of how we can change the market structure and change incentives and build, you know, if we can build, you know, an X billion or trillion market in AI governance tools, that's actually a good thing. You'll have a lot of innovation coming from there. We see that innovation happening already in this space. You know, the US could be a pioneer in building AI tools that are both responsible, have the appropriate guardrails, and do the wonderful things we want AI to do for us. I think there's a lot of hope there. So I think procurement is a great thing to do.
So if this is a unique and important kind of bargaining chip, you know, if you will, or ability to shape the market, as you said, what should that look like? How should the government use that purchasing power?
I think what the government should say is we want to buy quality products from vendors. We expect that any product we purchase with, you know, taxpayer money comes with a set of guarantees, comes with a set of assurances, quality controls. And those assurances and quality controls should be based on the principles outlined in the AI Bill of Rights. Things about safety testing, effectiveness testing, anti-discrimination provisions, you know, bias mitigation, ongoing monitoring, explainability and transparency. These are all things that you can do with systems that you build as a developer. And the government will say, we expect you to have documentation, transparency, reporting on all these things that you produce for us if you want us to buy your systems.
We'll be right back. You made a comment earlier about how sort of with the government having limited power, if you will, in what it can do without Congress acting, purchasing power is kind of an important component of the administration's response to AI. I wonder from your experience, you know, how limited is kind of the administration's reach here? How far can they go before sort of Congress has to really step up?
So the administration has, you know, to the extent that agencies have authorities given to them by Congress, the government has power to tell agencies how they should conduct their business, right? And, you know, and again, there's oversight. It's not like agencies can do it on the General Accounting Office sort of provides oversight over this.
Right.
So that's fine too, and that's appropriate. But that is a lot of power that the federal government does have. And I think the federal government can do more things, right? Agencies have regulatory authorities. HUD has authorities. The Department of Labor has authorities. Health and Human Services has authorities. authority to regulate products and systems under their jurisdiction. And the EO should encourage them to do those things as well. The federal government also has money power, not directly in terms of procurement, but in terms of the way federal agencies grant money to state and local jurisdictions to their work. And this, especially, for example, in the realm of policing and in criminal justice, the Department of Justice gives out a lot of grants to state and local entities and can say, look, if we're going to give you money to use AI or automated systems in your own work, again, you need to make sure that these systems have the appropriate checks and balances in place. So there are many tools that the federal government has at disposal. It is obviously not the same thing as having laws that cover both private and public sector uses, but it's not a small thing in and of itself.
That's very true. I was wondering, you know, when you were drafting the AI Bill of Rights, did you sort of have the latitude to kind of dream big, and or did you have to, when you were crafting that, sort of take into consideration some of these limits and how far, you know, the White House can push things?
I think we did a number of things in the document, and the document has that. Every principle has associated with it both the harms coming from not adhering to the principle, the way you can put that principle into practice, and what people have already done so far. And we give a number of examples. And I think giving those examples was deliberately done to show that there's a wide variety of activities that are already happening that can be continued and built upon to sort of bring the Bill of Rights to life. To your point about, you know, dreaming big, I think, you know, the goal was definitely to dream big, but it was also important to get feedback. The world is a complicated place. We want to learn from everyone who has experience dealing with these issues, whether it's different agencies, the private sector, civil society, advocates for communities. They all had important perspectives that weighed in very heavily into what actually ended up in the document. So we dreamt big, definitely, but then we asked people, does this make any sense? How would this look in your sector? And they said, well, these are things that don't really work for us. These are things we need to deal. These are challenges we are facing. And then the document was adapted and edited accordingly based on what they were telling us. So it was a project that I think brought in a lot of people to weigh in. And if it seems sweeping, it's perhaps because everyone felt that, you know, we do need to say these kinds of things.
You know, it's interesting. I wonder in that process of getting that feedback, especially from agencies, you know, this executive order, it's anticipated will provide some direction for agencies about how to implement AI or regulate AI. Having talked to a lot of those agencies, heard their own sort of concerns or questions about AI, what do you hope this executive order addresses, or what do you think it needs to address to help those agencies make sense of all this?
There are a lot of government agencies that I think are very committed to working with new technologies and doing it well. And there are a lot of people in these agencies who are very well versed in all the issues around how to use AI responsibly. And I think what they have been hoping for, and what they were hoping for when we were talking to them, was strong signals that this is a priority, that this is something that is worth spending their time on. They were doing this for love of it, because they cared. And they wanted some sense that this is something that, you know, the entire administration feels important. So, you know, The Biden administration made, you know, a number of signals along the way as to why it thinks that, you know, technology governance is very important. And I think this EO will be another very strong signal that this is a priority for the government, and the agencies have license now to go in and do what they have to do. So I think folks and agencies are ready to do something, and they need the mandate and the authority and the guidance from above to do it. And so when the EO comes out, and hopefully soon after that, the OMB guidance comes out, I think those two things together will give agencies a lot of concrete actions they can take to build governance structures and have the authority to build governance structures into the way they use these technologies.
You and I connected back and forth over Twitter, now X. You had sort of expressed some skepticism about this idea of requiring licenses to develop AI, which is an idea percolating here in Washington. Some companies like Microsoft have endorsed that. I've not gotten the impression the executive order is going to go quite that far, but I think there may be some requirements around tracking, you know, who's building kind of these foundational models or rather frontier models, large language models. What do you make of that? Does that raise kind of any of the same concerns you would have about a licensing regime?
I think a licensing regime is very tricky. And I think we talked about that in our exchanges on X, right? It's tricky because, first of all, you have to be a little suspicious when the only people asking for licensing are the ones who already have the systems in place, like OpenAI. <Right. laughs> So you have to say, what's the catch here? That's one thing, I think. But more broadly, I think the licensing discussion also exposes what is still a persistent confusion about the different ways in which we talk about AI. And what I mean by that is, you mentioned foundation models, you mentioned, you know, large language models, and a lot of the discussions about licensing are focusing on those models. The thing is that the space of AI systems that affect us is much, much broader than LLMs or foundation models, you know, many of which are not really fully deployed yet in places that are critically affecting our lives, right? Whether it's our opportunities for advancement or access to services and so on. And so when we talk about whether it's licensing, whether it's any other policy, I think it's going to be really important. And I'm going to be looking for this in the EO to make sure that we are clear about the kinds of systems we're focused on and what kinds of policies we have in place. Because I'm hearing a lot of confusion about the policies we need and the systems we're talking about. And there seems to be at cross purposes, right? Something that may be appropriate, like, you know, issues around copyright and whose data is being used, make a lot of sense for large language models and for image generation systems. They don't make the same kind of sense for a predictive model that's predicting who gets a loan and who doesn't get a loan. For that, there's a whole bunch of other issues, right? And so I think understanding which kinds of AI, flavors of AI technologies are being governed by the EO, hopefully all of them, and what specific policies are being put in place is going to be important to making sure the EO is actually effective and not just, you know, a lot of sound and fury.
Right. Well, folks from the administration may be listening to today's podcast, and the executive order is not finalized until it's published. Right. If you're reading the EO a couple of days or a couple of weeks from now, I mean, what's the one or two main things you're looking for to judge whether it does enough?
I want the EO to not be focused solely on, you know, large language models or foundation models or whatever you want to call these. I want it to be focused on uses of machine learning and AI broadly. I want it to be focused on any scenario where there's a material impact on people, an ongoing impact, which means, you know, hiring, which means education, which means criminal justice, health and human services, all these areas. I want it to talk assertively and strongly about anti-discrimination provisions, about civil rights. I want it to have strong provisions for pre-deployment testing, for validation, transparency, and broad governance guidelines. Basically, it should have as many elements of the AI Bill of Rights as it can have, really, because there was a reason why those things were all put in place. And then I think it may not get every single one of these things, but I will look for all these things in there. And if it doesn't, and if it sort of focuses primarily on, say, security issues only, like, you know, disinformation or about people hacking the systems, then I will be disappointed at how narrow it's become. If it's only focusing on foundation models, then I will be disappointed at how an opportunity has been lost to really speak broadly about AI. So these are the things I'll be looking for.
Excellent. Well, Suresh, I'll either look for your comments on X, where we first connected, or we'll have to have you back on the podcast. But I appreciate you being here.
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, and I'm looking forward to seeing what comes next.
Before you go, I've got a quick update on microchips. A few recent episodes have focused on the Commerce Department potentially putting new restrictions on the export of microchips to China. Well, the agency took that step on Tuesday, tamping down on the sale of some sophisticated chips used for artificial intelligence. The export controls are likely to bite American firms like Intel and NVIDIA. And already, the Semiconductor Industry Association wants other countries to match them, an effort to avoid putting U.S. companies at a disadvantage. You can expect us to keep reporting on the geopolitics at play. But that's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's show comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our senior producer is Annie Reese. Our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. I'll see you back here tomorrow.